Hi, I'm Tim Grierson.
And hi, I'm Will Leach, and this is the Grierson Unleashed podcast, episode 32. It is the end of summer podcast, and it is the end of summer. Grierson, have you enjoyed your summer? The real question I feel like we ask you and really any film critic, did you go outside this summer?
I actually went out a decent amount, I have to say, this summer. I was very happy about that. I think partly because the movies were so bad this summer that I kind of needed a good break from being inside theaters.
Going outside does not just mean traveling from your house to the movies.
No. Actually, yes. Now where I live, because now you've been here, you see where I live now. It's a nice kind of like foresty kind of open field area. And so I have like all these nice walks I do now. So yes, I was actually outdoors, not just walking from my car to the theater and back.
Think about how many movies you could have seen in that time that you were wasting out in the outdoors. Anyway, so this is the reason I get kind of on our summer discussion is this is our end of summer podcast. Labor Day, of course, is coming up. College football here in Athens, Georgia is about to take over everything within a 350 to 800 mile radius. So we are going to wrap up our summer with this podcast. Of course, we remind you, as always, to please follow us on Twitter at Grierson Leach and subscribe to us on iTunes and really give us a nice review on iTunes. If you do so and list the name of a movie you would like us to see, we will review your movie and read your review aloud in our reboot section, as I will do right now, because we have two reboot movies to get to after we do our big summer movie wrap-up. The first comes to us from Jonas Weezer, Jonas_Weezer. Great and fair reviews, 5 stars. I'm a big fan of this podcast and love hearing their takes on new and classic movies. I think they try to be very fair to every movie in terms of criticism, but also aren't afraid to savagely berate or gushingly praise a movie when they feel it is deserved. I love their weekly reboot section too, where they review past films chosen by fans. It helps inform where their taste in films comes from. I hope they'll do my favorite movie from my time in college, Garden State, sometime in the future. So, in our second reboot section, we'll actually be discussing Garden State. In our first reboot section, review comes to us from Estimated Profit. There's a number 8 in there and no E in profit, so I assume that there was a lot of estimated profits on iTunes. Awesome podcast, 5 stars. Hi, Kristen Leach. Hi, Estimated Profit.
Hello there.
Hey. Number 8, no E. I've been a dedicated listener since the first week, and I love your podcast. I go to the movies pretty much once every weekend, and I find most reviews to be spot on. I laughed so hard when you guys reviewed Batman vs Superman. Anyways, I would love it if you know, it's funny, Grierson. People comment on that podcast all the time, and I just remember being like mostly upset during that podcast.
Yeah, that's sort of our equivalent of when people tell Bob Dylan how much Blood on the Tracks means to them. He's like, well, that's great, because that album was a lot of pain for me to make. Yeah. So yeah, I'm glad that our suffering, by the way, is Profit spelled P-R-O-F-I-T or P-O-P-H-E-T?
No, P-R-O-P-H-T, a prophet of rage.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Exactly. If you were a prophet, you know that. Anyways, says Estimated 8 Profit. Anyways, I would love it if you were to review one of my favorite movies of all time, Almost Famous, directed by Cameron Crowe, for your reboot section. Thank you so much, and keep up the great work. So, we will be discussing Almost Famous and Garden State. Should be a festive conversation, I suspect. But first, we need to wrap up this dreary, wretched, upsetting, very bad summer movies. Before we even start, Grierson, am I overstating it? Like, you've seen most summer movies for a long time now. As I said, I'm just sort of dabbling in this world. But you have been through lots of summer movies. Is this the worst summer movie season that you can remember?
In terms of big summer movies, yeah. And if there was one worse, I don't want to recall it, and perhaps I have suppressed it. But yeah, this was, I think I have across the board, there were some good big movies, and we'll talk about that. But for the most part, I think the best you could hope for were not bad or better than I was expecting or not as good as the movies that came before it in the series. That was kind of like, I feel like, the baseline for most things we talked about this summer.
Now, is this something, you know, I've written a lot of things, a lot of people have written about, Matt Singer's actually written a lot about this as well, about, is this endemic? Like, is this just the way it's going to be now? It's just the way that movies are made and packaged and sold and processed. this is just what's going to happen. You're going to get an Alice in Wonderland movie that nobody wants or nobody cares about. Or were these movies, even in that kind of understanding that this is the cultural, the marketplace that we're in, do you think they were even bad, even relatively speaking to that?
It's hard to know. I mean, part of me feels like it's not the trend of something, or the sign of something to come. Partly because I think I just don't want to believe that. I want to kind of believe that this was just I think that it does depend on the movies. Ultimately, it does depend on the movies. I think this is part of an overriding trend, which is that we're going to get more sequels, we're going to get more reboots, we're going to get more remakes. I think that's just a given. But I feel like for the most part, this crop of movies this summer were not necessarily the best of what we have to offer in terms of franchises and things like that. Part of me doesn't want to think it can get worse than this, or that this is just going to be the way. I'm too much of an optimistic soul mm-hmm. to kind of believe that. So I am willing to kind of write this summer off as just one of those weird fluke things. Because I think, honestly, like if you think about like the Batman movies and Christopher Nolan coming in there, you know, I think that you just need the right filmmaker or the right couple of filmmakers who reinvent these things, and then they feel fresh all over again. You really just didn't have that this summer. And so I'm not willing to do the doom and gloom thing just yet.
Kirsten, you're never willing to do the doom and gloom thing. Well, I think it's good. That's one of the many reasons I like you. Okay, one of the like one or two reasons that I like you.
Oh, thanks.
You're welcome. All right, so we did a little piece for The New Republic. What we learned from this summer, we broke the summer into a bunch of different categories. So I'm going to ask you yours, and you can ask me mine. First off, Gerson, we were talking about those big movies. Give me your best big movie of the summer.
My best big movie was the sequel to Finding Nemo, Finding Dory, Andrew Stanton's first animation or animated film since he did WALL-E. He then went on to do John Carter, that live-action debacle. Finding Dory I thought was really, really funny and really, really touching. And though it's not as great as either Finding Nemo or WALL-E, it's not quite as inspired as either one of those movies. To me, this was Pixar kind of hitting on all... I mean, this to me felt like their greatest hits. And the hits still are pretty fresh. It's funny. It's lively. It's got great action sequences. It's got a great voice cast. It's got a lot of feeling behind it. The fact that it did so well this summer, I think, speaks to the fact that it was one of the few really good big summer movies this year. So kind of by a wide margin, that was my favorite.
All right. Well, my best movie was a tie, which I know you hate and I hate and I get it.
We have to talk about this for a second. Will and I never read each other's stuff ahead of time before we do it. I couldn't help myself. I wanted to see what Will put. I got a bone to pick with you, man, because we're both big anti-tie people, so I'm waiting for you to justify this right now. But go ahead. You had two movies that tied for you.
My justification for this is I'm really not crazy about either one of these movies, and I knew you were going to pick Finding Dory, and one of them is Finding Dory, which is a movie that I found charming. I could have done without the truck-driving octopus at the end, but we've already covered that in a previous podcast. But I do think it is like the other movie that I put here, Captain America Civil War. It is a movie that is within the parameters of what it does. It does it, I think, very well. These are both great examples of really expert reheating of food. That's what this is. This is really the expert. We're not getting a new meal, but they are doing a good job of preparing something that we have eaten before but will enjoy again. And so to me, I found them so thematically together, not so much the movies themes, but just kind of my theme of the summer in that, wow, there were like tons of movies where they were just trying to either repackage something that you'd already had and saying you'll like it again, or trying to set you up to like future helpings of something that you've at least heard of in the past. And so all of those movies all kind of came together, all kind of ran together to me. So these were the two that I thought were halfway decent. So if you were to really ask me to twist my arm, I would say that I probably like Captain America Civil War a little bit more, but I don't really care either way, which is another reason. Let's call it less a tie. Like, if we were like ranking, if we ranked all the movies that we saw, one to so on, I would not say these two movies are tied. But for the purposes of this exercise, I said these of all of the movies that were trying to do the same things, these were the two only two that I thought did it halfway decently. So I'll put them both there. But if you were to ask me which one I actually prefer, I would probably say I prefer Civil War.
I'll allow it. But if you try to pull some trick where you like pick a TV show as the best movie of the year, then we'll have some issues, but that's okay.
That will never happen, Grierson. I will die. If that happens, I have been subsumed by the Borg, and it's not me. It's not me, and it's somebody else. Shoot that guy.
Though I have to say, this is kind of a perfect segue to your best small movie.
Yes, because some would say it's a TV show. No, it is not, in fact, a TV show, though. My small movie, it's weird because not only is it considered by some a TV show, it is, in fact, made by one of the most powerful media corporations in the country.
I wasn't going to say it, but it definitely disqualified it for me, though. I had a small movie I like better, but yes. Anyway, go ahead, yes.
My small movie, and also it's 8 hours long. Another thing that's not small, but my best small movie was O.J. Made in America. And the way that I justified this to myself for making this a small movie is just kind of the unlikelihood of his existence, of kind of the idea that this was some big, you know, it also played in two theaters. Like, that's small.
Yeah,
that's
very small. Absolutely. It literally played in two theaters. Absolutely. I totally agree. And most people, I think, to this day don't know, number one, that this film exists, and number two, that it is going to be treated like a film, and it is going to be up for best documentary consideration for the Oscars this year.
Yeah, I was talking to my colleague, our friend Joe Reed, who writes for Decider and late of the Extra Hot Great podcast and Buffalo Bills fan, which is, sorry. But I was talking to him about this, and he was putting together his mid-year top tens, and he didn't include this. I was like, oh, you didn't like it? He's like, no, I just keep forgetting that it's a movie. And it is a movie, and I wonder when it becomes Oscar time, when it becomes, like, I'm assuming they'll do a big push, but it just doesn't feel like anyone, even though it is by the rules that we have been putting together for these for years and years and years, and not just us, it counts as a movie. I don't think anyone's considering it a movie.
Yes, I'll be very curious what happens as we get closer into the fall. But I know for a fact, you know, being a member of the LA Film Critics, they have made screenings available for us. So I think that is definitely...
They are making a push.
Yeah, they are going to make a push, and I think they will continue to make a push. I think right now they're just kind of waiting at this point. Because I had, you know, in terms of reviews this year, if not the best, you know, right up there in the top two or three best reviewed movies of the year. So I think they can kind of sit back and wait. I tease, but I also, of course, as we talked about at the, you know, halfway point of the year podcast, I'm, of course, a big fan of this movie as well. So, of course, I approve as well.
Hey, and one last thing on this movie. I'm a sports writer. Some people know this. And my side project, sports writing is my side project to this. And to me, one of the things that's very powerful about Made in America is the themes, it contains so many themes, but all of them remain deeply relevant today. And I think we saw a great example of this when San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick announced this weekend that he's not standing up for the national anthem because of what he doesn't want to stand for the flag of a country that oppresses African Americans the way that it does. Now, whatever your thoughts about the fact that he's doing that, whether you approve, whether you don't approve, whether you think he's great, whether you think he's a jerk, to me, this so jives so much with one of the more interesting and big pivot moments, as I wrote about in my column for Sports on Earth on Sunday, which was the moment where Jim Brown and Bill Russell and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Muhammad Ali all in 1967 make this big movement to say we are trying to be a part of a big social movement, and O.J. Simpson clearly rejects it. And I feel like that moment has never really happened in sports since then, and I wonder if a moment like this is a pivot moment where people, now someone's going to go ask Cam Newton, hey, what do you think of what Colin Kaepernick said? And he's going to have to take a stand. Even not taking a stand will be taking a stand. And so I think, and I felt like that with like so many other things I come across on a daily basis was very well put in the context of what O.J. Made in America put together. So it's really, really great. So Grierson, what is your best small movie?
The movie that I talked about at the halfway point, the documentary or the quasi-documentary, The Other Side, about a group of people living in the deep swamps of rural Louisiana. We talked about this on the podcast for the halfway point, but just to sort of recap, It just sort of chronicles these people's existence. It's a director named Roberto Minervini. What he does is he met these people, these real life people, interviewed them, filmed them, and then from their lives gave them sort of scripted things or based on their experiences kind of recreated certain elements. That's the first half of the movie. The second half of the movie is him essentially hanging out with a makeshift militia and basically just sort of observing them as they're blowing shit up and talking about how much they hate Obama and how they want the country to change and how they think the country is going in the wrong direction. You talked about OJ Made in America and how this summer things have happened in the sports world that have reflected what that movie is about. I would agree with everything you said and add, the NBA players standing up against gun violence and talking about that as well. And that also being a thing. To me, I saw The Other Side back in March. And for me this summer, with all of the Trump stuff and all this conversation about that Trump is speaking for a certain kind of disenfranchised, angry, kind of white, male, uneducated American, I thought about The Other Side a lot this summer and how, to me, I despise Trump. I kind of hate the cynicism of his campaign. A movie like The Other Side, I think, really speaks eloquently to people who are legitimately feeling like they are lost in America and the direction that America is going. And for me, what I love about The Other Side, among the other things, is that I think it actually has a great amount of compassion for those people and tries to give them a legitimate voice as opposed to treating them like some sort of white trash freak show. It still has not played around most of the country, unfortunately. It still hasn't even opened in Los Angeles yet. I am hoping that that will be rectified by the end of this year.
We did discuss that movie on the podcast. I was less enthralled with it by you, as you were. I found it very compelling, but also, as we mentioned on that podcast, there are certain parts that are scripted and certain parts that are not scripted, and I wasn't sure what I was supposed to trust, and therefore I found it distinct from the movie. But I know that you like it. I think you made some of your points you make. I think it's certainly worth people searching out, but definitely be careful where you watch it. Like, if you don't see it in the theater, there's some stuff in that movie that you don't want to watch on, say, a plane. All right, so Grierson, this is really the big question. This is really the only question. Of all the movies that you saw, which one was the worst one?
I bet most listeners know this. Because in terms of meltdowns that we had on the podcast, Warcraft's terrible. Warcraft is awful. And not to kick, this is actually the thing I want to say about Warcraft. As somebody who really liked Duncan Jones' first film, Moon, I was a little less excited about his second movie. This, to me, I thought was a bitter, bitter disappointment. I have to acknowledge that I'm sure for someone like Duncan Jones, people not liking Warcraft doesn't mean much when his father, David Bowie, died this year. And so there is a part of me that feels like I don't want to kick this movie too much because of what Duncan Jones has gone through this year. But that being said, I feel like this is the type of anonymous, CGI heavy, don't worry, we're making room for lots of sequels that hopefully will never get made, type of big action event movie that, to Matt Singer's earlier point, I am very concerned that we are going to get more and more and more of. This is a movie that strands a cast of really capable actors, including Dominic Cooper and Ben Foster, and most especially Paula Patton, and just kind of buries them and ruins them. You would never believe they could ever act. It's not dissimilar, honestly, from the Star Wars prequels. And for a brief time, people thought, wait, can Natalie Portman and Ewan McGregor not act? Did they forget? Do they forget? Or did we get confused and think they could act? No, they can act. It's just in this world, they could not escape with their credibility, unfortunately. It did well overseas. We may get a sequel for this movie. Good God, it's awful.
Yes, I have to admit, this is probably my worst movie of the year, too. I just admit, it really, like, sucked away your soul to live so thoroughly and forced you into such a moment of existential despair that I didn't feel comfortable choosing it. It's just so closely associated with you. I dislike this movie. You really dislike this. You gave this movie an F, Grierson, and I don't think you've done that in decades, right?
Not in decades. It's been like maybe 5 years. I have to go back and look through my all my pages of grades for movies, but it's the most recent F. Going back to the election really fast, you know, people talk a lot about the fact that Hillary Clinton's unfavorables are really low, or really bad, rather, and if she wasn't running against Donald Trump, they'd be historic. I feel like in some ways Alice Through the Looking Glass is like the Hillary Clinton of unfavorables in terms of movies. Like, because we both hate that movie too, but because of the existence of Warcraft, that movie kind of gets a pass almost. Like, it sort of escapes being slimed as the worst movie we saw this summer. So lucky for you, Alice Through the Looking Glass, that Warcraft exists.
Man, it is bad though.
That movie's terrible too.
So that's the one I chose just because I couldn't take Warcraft from you. But yeah, it's definitely pretty bad. All right. So one other category we have in here is the biggest surprise, like kind of one takeaway that you would have expected going into the summer to happen. What was your biggest surprise?
I had never been a huge, tremendous super fan of the X-Men movies when Bryan Singer did them back in the early 2000s. So my sort of pleasant surprise was how much I liked X-Men Apocalypse. And, you know, it's a movie that did not get very good reviews. Well, you also did not like it. And I had actually seen it twice in the theater. And I really enjoyed it both times. I find Singer as an action filmmaker, especially in comparison to Batman vs. Superman or some of the other kind of bad action movies we had this summer, I think that he does action movie geography really well. And it actually makes a difference because I was able to follow what was going on in the action sequences. And I actually feel like they built emotionally to, I thought, a pretty strong ending. I know people don't like Oscar Isaac in this because they feel like he's just sort of buried under makeup and costume. And I get that. But I have to say, I have a certain fondness for the kind of like all-knowing, super powerful bad guy that he is in this movie. I enjoy this movie. I enjoy its cast. I like Michael Fassbender. I like Jennifer Lawrence. I like James McAvoy in these movies. It's not as good as Days of Future Past, the one before this one. But I had a kind of a kick both times I saw it. So much to my surprise, I am a big X-Men defender in my life now.
Yeah, I'm not with you on this one. And I do think people did kind of want to pile on this a little bit. I think the timing of this, it kind of became the superhero movie where people were like, all right, enough. And Oscar Isaac is the internet's boyfriend. So everybody was like, why is he buried under all this CGI and so on? So I think that wasn't really fair, though. I don't think he's actually that good in the movie. So I agree that the movie was a little piled on too much, but I don't think it rises to the level that you have it. I don't think it's that good, but it surprised you. So, you know,
hence, who can explain the logic of a surprise?
Exactly. I can't debate your surprise. my surprise is just how listless and dull Jason Bourne was. You know, as mentioned before, I am a Paul Greengrass honk. I think I actually use that exact phrasing every time I actually say it. I'm a Paul Greengrass honk, even up to his last movie, Captain Phillips, which I think is very, very good. This was, you know, Matt Damon famously said he would not come back and do another one of these unless Greengrass came back. And all three of those, the last two movies, the first one not directed by Paul Greengrass, but the last two, which I think were even better, they all felt like urgent and vital and of the moment. And this felt... It was not only a surprise, but a very disappointing surprise to realize that, oh, they're just steering this back into the franchise lane again. And I thought, it's clear that Greengrass, after he made the last one, The Bourne Ultimatum, said, I'm not going to do another one of these because I told the story I had to tell. And now that we've seen Jason Bourne, it's very clear that is, in fact, what happened. He told the story he had to tell and kind of came back, did not have the energy, did not have the excitement. And it was definitely a bummer of a surprise how kind of dull Jason Bourne was.
Yeah, and to me, Jason Bourne, that movie, represents kind of my overall grade for most summer movies I saw, which was good enough. I thought it was good enough. I'm not, as we talked about on that episode of the podcast, it's hard to defend this movie too strenuously, and I don't feel like doing it because it's not that good. I think it's a perfectly competent Jason Bourne movie. And maybe if you'd never seen any of the other ones, you'd think, oh, this is really kind of innovative and cool or whatever. But it is kind of a movie that does not need to exist and strains really hard to find a reason to exist. I will say, I think Alicia Vikander is quite fun in the movie. That isn't enough to heartily recommend this movie, but it is, I think, to the point of what we faced a lot this summer, which was, okay, there's another one of these. Nobody knows why. It's just they just want to make more money. And they want not even make more money. They just want to kind of keep this thing in the cultural firmament for a little longer. And that's what, there are a lot of placeholders this summer, I have to say. Star Trek felt that way. Even Ghostbusters kind of felt that way to a certain extent. This one, I think, really felt that way. So I as a green grass honk, of course, you would be sorely disappointed by this movie.
All right, so next up, give me, I think this will be the last one of our little section that we review, and then we have some more stuff we want to talk about. What did you think the best performance of the summer was?
For me, it was Colin Farrell in The Lobster. I think he is tremendous in this movie, and this was one of the bright spots of the summer, I felt like. Not only was this movie out this summer, but it actually found an audience, which I was really, really happy about because I was not sure if it would. For anyone who has not seen The Lobster or is not familiar with it, it's set in a near-future society where you must be paired off with a significant other within 45 days or you are turned into an animal. Colin Farrell plays a newly dumped man. His wife has left him for another man. And so he is sent to this hotel where you have to find a new mate. I've liked Colin Farrell for quite some time. He's one of those actors who I kept being convinced just wasn't finding the right roles. This is the right role for him. He kind of beefed up for this role. He's kind of pudgy in this movie. He does so much work with his kind of melancholy eyes. He is such a sad sack in this beautiful but also funny way in this movie that I had a very tough time not watching him on screen. My heart goes out to this character, but I think Farrell also makes it really, really funny at the same time. This character learns as he goes along in the movie that you don't really need to find true love. You just need to find somebody that you can tolerate. And I think that the movie's overall message about how screwed up modern-day romance and relationships are, that comes through beautifully in Farrell's performance. I don't think he has much of a chance for an Oscar nomination for this, but I think it's definitely deserving. He's funny, he's sad, he's great. The movie is great, and so is he.
Yeah, I have no arguments with a single word that you said there. One of the things you brought up when we talked about this in the podcast was kind of the wonder that this was Yorgos Lanthimos, who did Dogtooth, which I really love, and you like as well. I like more than you do. This is his first English language movie, and it gets that still exactly right. The vocal intonations, the timing, the comedic timing, all this is so perfect. And that a lot of that had to come from the actors. And I feel like Farrell is like, there's a lot of people that are really good in the movie, but Farrell is really at the center of it. And I feel like a lot of people are all kind of working off what he's giving.
Yeah. It's a great performance. Like I said, I'm so happy the movie, caught on. This summer. So I am curious to hear what your best performance was.
I actually think does have a chance, to be honest, and a supporting role, just because I think even people that didn't like the movie very much have all kind of understood, have all accepted, like, wow, he's really awesome in this. He also has two nominations already. I think Jonah Hill in War Dogs is just this very... It's this new kind of creation. Like, the movie is not nearly as inventive as he is in this. For him to, okay, we just started this podcast last week, but so I don't want to go too down the rabbit hole. But, and also I kept bringing up, oh, here's another thing I liked about Jonah Hill. We never finished our War Dog section. I was like, oh, here's another thing. And he's like, well, we're ready to move on. But Jonah Hill is both creepy and scary without, and psychotic without ever... and dangerous without ever like going over the top with it. It's kind of a slow build performance that's funny, but also scary. And it's just a very, very smart way to play a character that, as you put in the podcast this week, could have just been the Joe Pesci crazy guy. It's a really kind of fully rounded performance. It's really not even a funny performance that I've put away all my Jonah Hill reservations and said, this guy is awesome. I think it's of all the performances I think of the summer, that's the one, even though I'm not crazy about the movie either, though I do like it more than you do. That's the performance I'll remember.
Yeah, it's a good performance. And since we talked about it, I won't dive into it again, but I, as a longtime Jonah Hill fan, I'm more just happy that you are now on board, with Mr. Hill. So yes.
Okay. What's a movie that you, a couple more things more left to do. What is a movie that you wanted to get to this summer and didn't get to, and as soon as you get a chance, you're going to hit?
I would say the documentary Gleason is one that I keep hearing from people. And have you seen it, Will? I don't think
I haven't. I haven't, no.
Yeah, for, you know, since I haven't seen it, but, you know, for people who aren't familiar with it, it's a documentary about the New Orleans Saints player, Steve Gleason, who has ALS, and it's about his life basically since football. It is funny because, you know, obviously people know I'm a film critic and will ask me what I've seen or what I've liked. And sometimes people will ask me if I've seen a certain thing because they liked it and they're curious if I liked it too. And Gleason's the one that I have to say probably came up the most of movies I have not seen yet. So it clearly has struck a chord with people. I haven't seen it yet. I'm really curious to check it out.
Yeah, and mine is a movie that you reviewed for us at the New Republic and is now sitting in my iTunes waiting for my next flight to watch. It is The Fitz, directed by Anna Rose Holmer, excuse me. And you were a big fan of that movie, and it's all my, and it is a movie that played here in Athens, and I just missed it. I'm very excited to see it. It's about a 11-year-old girl who joins a all-girl dance team, correct? Do I have that correct? Don't tell me anymore. I haven't seen it, but
yeah.
I've got the basics. You know,
that's the basics. You got it, yeah.
Okay, so The Fitz is the movie that I have not gotten to, and I want to. All right, Kirsten, are there movies? I don't have any because you see more movies than I do because I'm always getting caught up on all these flights. But you... what movies did you love this summer or you would like to talk about? This is your last chance because we're closing down the summer, closing up shop. No more shopping days till September. What movies did you want to get into in this podcast? Give us a couple, just a little bit on some movies that you would have loved to have seen, talked about in this podcast. Last chance to talk about them from this summer.
Yeah. I mean, really briefly, I really enjoyed the documentary called Under the Sun. It is about a filmmaker who was hired by North Korea to make a propaganda film about how great life is in North Korea. And they approved the script. They basically wrote the script, cast it, and basically told the filmmaker, you're going to do this exactly the way we want you to, and we're going to be observing the whole thing to make sure you don't do anything fast and loose. Well, what he did was he actually had one of his crew do a second film at the same time that showed what was really going on behind the scenes of this official propaganda film. It's really fascinating, specifically because in documentaries, and this I think applies to the other side, there's this question about what's real, what's not. Are documentaries in and of themselves a kind of fiction? I think this movie kind of dives into that in a really, really clever way. It's this really audacious film, and it's also really, really funny at the same time. I would also give a quick shout out to a movie that came out this last weekend called Complete Unknown. This stars Rachel Weisz and Michael Shannon. Michael Shannon plays a married man who's having a dinner party. Rachel Weisz comes as the guest of one of his friends to the dinner party, and she pretends like she's never met him. But she has met him. They used to go out a long time ago, and now she's pretending to be someone else. The movie is about Michael Shannon and Rachel Weisz essentially coming together to find out what happened to her because she walked out of his life so long ago. And it's almost sort of like an Eyes Wide Shut sort of like movie that you kind of can't take literally. But I think it's a really fun romantic drama slash thriller about kind of having a do-over in your life. Those are two I would say are worth giving a shot.
All right, so the last thing I want to do is, well, I because this is so sad, really, we've talked about all these bad movies, I want to look at next summer's calendar and see if we, because already these movies are in production, some of them are even out of production, some of them already have trailers that are going to be out next summer, and see if there's more hope. So here's what I'm going to do, Grayson. We're going to make a little game out of this. I'm going to give you a movie on a scale of 1 to 10. You tell me how excited you are about it.
Okay.
From next summer. I'm starting, by the way, with Fast 8, because I think Fast 8 is now the Fast Furious movies are the start of the summer the way that Will Smith movies used to be Independence Day. I think that's just the way it works now. So Fast 8, this time directed by F. Gary Gray, coming out on April 14th.
I'm going to give it a 6.
6, all right. May 5th, Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. James Gunn gets back together with the old Marvel guys.
I give it a 7.
Mother Daughter, directed by Jonathan Devine, and starring Amy Schumer and Goldie Hawn.
I'm going to say 7.
May 19th, Baywatch. By the way, there are like 5 Rock movies coming out, movies with The Rock next year. Baywatch, directed by Seth Gordon, rated R, with The Rock, Alexandra Daddario, and Zac Efron.
Sight Unseen, I'm going to say 3.
3, all right. May 26th, Pirates of the Caribbean.
Dead 0, 0, negative 14.
This one has Javier Bardem.
Negative 12. I don't care. Nothing. Yeah, 0.
Ominously mentioned in the credits here, Paul McCartney. So that's going to be fun.
Wait, is he related to Keith Richards' character from the other one?
Perhaps. They're rivals, I'm sure. Yes, exactly. June 2nd, Wonder Woman, directed by Patty Jenkins, starring Gal Gadot, Chris Pine, Connie Nielsen, Robin Wright, so on.
I would say 8.
8, that's not bad. June 9th, The Mummy, directed by Alex Kurtzman and starring Tom Cruise, Russell Crowe.
I'm going to say 6.
Cars 3 on June 16th?
1, like maybe a half. I'm not you, Will. I'm not excited about any more Cars movies. No.
June 16th, Kingsman: The Golden Circle, directed by Matthew Vaughn.
Okay,
you hate this.
I'm starting to hate you. Actually, why are you? This is also a negative 12 for me.
Tim hates the first Kingsman movie. This
don't
one,
worry, don't worry. Colin Firth is coming back. Apparently, even though they killed him off in the last one, he's coming back. So
also this one, apparently, looking through the credit list, Jeff Bridges, Julianne Moore, Channing Tatum, Elton John. What is going on? All right.
June, that sounds like half of a Big Lebowski remake, by the way. Or a sequel. Go ahead. Yes.
June 23rd, Transformers: The Last Night, directed by Michael Bay, starring Mark Wahlberg.
I'm going to stop you right here. Before we got on the mic, we talked about the fact that both of us thought, hey, maybe next summer will be better. This is actually making me sad. This is also like a negative a billion for me. I forgot that they're making their Transformers movie. Yeah.
Yes. June 30th, The House, a comedy directed by Andrew J. Cohen, in which Will Ferrell and Amy Poehler open up a casino in their basement.
I'm going to say 4.
July 17th, 7th, Spider-Man Homecoming. Spider-Man's welcoming back into the Marvel Universe, directed by John Watts, starring Tom Holland, Michael Keaton, Donald Glover, and Tyne Daly.
I actually want to hear your one for this. I would give this about a 4.
I found the Spider-Man character very fun in Civil War. Yes. But that's the upside. The downside is I can't watch any more goddamn Spider-Man movies.
I kind of feel the same way, man. Like,
I think the advantage here is apparently this is not an origin story, which is great because I can't watch any more of those. No more origin stories.
Yes. Which family member gets shot this time? Yeah.
Seriously. All right. July 14th. I'm really excited about this one. July starts getting a little better, Grierson, I promise. July 14th, War for the Planet of the Apes, directed by Matt Reeves, a sequel to a movie that you loved.
Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Yes, I would give this a 9.5. I'm very excited. Wow. I'm very excited for that movie, yes.
Well, the next week you may be more excited. July 21st, Dunkirk, written and directed by Christopher Nolan, starring Tom Hardy, Cillian Murphy, Mark Rylance, Kenneth Branagh, and Harry Styles.
But what if you weren't a big fan of Interstellar? I'd still say like a 9 or so. But yes, yeah. I'm worried about Nolan, I gotta say.
Yeah, Interstellar had me worried too. July 21st, one of the fun Comic-Con movies this year, Valerian and the City of 1,000 Planets, written and directed by Luc Besson, starring Dane DeHaan, Clive Owen, Ethan Hawke, John Goodman, and Rihanna, the cast that we've all been waiting for.
I loved Lucy, so I would give this a 6.
August 4th, Alien Covenant, directed by Ridley Scott, starring Michael Fassbender, Billy Crudup, Danny McBride.
Is he an android too?
He's a different model from the Michael Fassbender. He's like an earlier, more buggy.
Yeah, what movie is he basing his persona on? Not Lawrence of Arabia, yes. Clearly. So I am a admitted fan of Prometheus, despite its many flaws, but I would say about a 3.
All right, we're coming to the end here. That's probably, unless we want to talk about an Equalizer sequel. That's probably enough. Oh, and American Made. August 29th, starring Tom Cruise, directed by Doug Liman.
I like their last collaboration, but I would say about a five. Yeah. Though we both like the first Equalizer, so... But yes, I don't think either of us are excited about another one of those, so yeah.
All right, so that is our summer movie wrap-up. I hope everybody enjoyed all their summer movies. You get a chance to... Now, Grierson, comes the serious movies.
Yes.
The movies that are important. The movies that are going to make a difference. The movies that are going to change lives. Like Yoga Hosers, written and directed by Kevin Smith.
Right. Yes, and Trolls, about Trolls. Really fast, I did watch Kubo and the Two Strings.
Yeah, what'd you think? I haven't seen it.
I give it a B+. I'm not as high on it as a lot of people are, but I think it's really good. But I will say what helped me like Kubo even more was seeing the trailer for Trolls before it. You would have to see my wife's face as she watched that trailer. It looks like it's going to make $1 billion, but... at what price? That movie looks absolutely atrocious. Trolls. From the makers of Shrek, Will.
That's good. I may have to make sure. If they would have made, the animators had made a previous movie about like cute things, I would be very wary. But now that I know that they've established their bona fides in the troll/ogre field, I trust them to make Trolls.
Yeah. There are two poop jokes in the trailer, by the way.
And scene. Okay, I think it's time to move on to something else other than that. Grierson, it's time for our reboot section. We're going to kick us off. Our big movie is Almost Famous.
Hey, man, take good care of her in San Francisco. Man.
One day, you'll be cool. Look under your bed. It'll set you free.
What's the plan?
Almost Famous came out in 2000. It's written and directed by Cameron Crowe, starring... starring Patrick Fugit as William Miller, a young rock journalist who, I don't know, seems maybe a little bit like Cameron Crowe, who maybe a lot bit like Cameron Crowe, who, like Cameron Crowe, wants to be a rock critic, has a relationship with Lester Bangs, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, wants to be a rock critic, but is still kind of like held down by the fact that he's 15, for example. On the road, of course, he meets the famous Penny Lane, directed by Kate Hudson, while serving the band Stillwater, led by Russell Hammond, Billy Crudup. Now, Grierson, lots of stuff to talk about Almost Famous. Lots of stuff to talk about Almost Famous. This movie, to a lot of people, is deeply beloved. What did you think about when you first saw it?
When I first saw it, back in 2000, I remember thinking, and that is genuinely what I thought. I still remember I was getting over a cold when I saw the movie and thought to myself, am I just under the weather and I'm not appreciating why this movie is so great? I thought it was perfectly fine and touching in certain ways, but I think it confirmed at the time when I saw it that I kind of have a low tolerance for Cameron Crowe as a filmmaker. I know what he does well. I appreciate what he does well, but a little bit goes a long way. For me. How about you? I feel like, did you like this more than I did? I'm trying to remember back in 2000.
I did, but it was never a movie that, this was never a movie that I felt particularly passionate about. I did like it. But I liked Lester Bangs. I liked Phil Seymour Hoffman. He was the one I remembered the most from the movie. I wished him wanting to be in it more, which was what struck me a little bit watching this time. Cause I have to say, the first hour of this movie is really, really good. The first hour, there's a moment, and we're going to get to that moment. There's a moment where you can just watch the air actually go out of the movie. I get excited to talk to you about this moment, Grierson. But I feel like the first hour is very smart. It's a little smart, but it's mostly like it feels very well observed and very like just on point in the way that when Cameron Crowe is good, he's really, really good at it. Like, you find characters who are a little kind of archetypes, but have a little spin on them and have a little bit more to them. And, like, there are just little scenes in the first half of this movie that are just delightful. Just these very lovely little tiny scenes. One of my favorite scenes for the first half of the movie is when Frances McDormand, who plays the mother, Elaine Miller, she plays the mother. She calls the hotel room and gets Fairuza Balk, who is Sapphire, one of the band aides from the movie. And she like stops and has this little little moment where she says, "Hey, your son's a good kid." And the movie, one of the Cameron Crowe's things is his characters are always a little bit more nice than they probably would be in the real world. And that sometimes some people have a short patience for that. But I feel like that scene is really perfect. And there's a lot of really perfect scenes that have the wonderful little punchline to walk off, that one being this is the maid, by the way, after they had this like perfect little conversation back and forth. There's all these little lovely little scenes that I have to say, I, as much as I thought I liked the movie the first time, I really thought I thought it landed really well. And I have to say, for the first hour of this movie, I was like, all right, I might not have been on this movie's wavelength in the year 2000. But I am on this movie's wavelength now. Now, before we get to the second hour of the movie, are you with me watching this movie again? Did you feel like you liked it the first half more?
I feel like I was more forgiving. But I have to admit, the one thing that you said that definitely I agree with is there is a niceness to this movie that is hard for me to entirely reconcile. It, to me, there is something, and I'm curious where this breaking point is for you in the movie, but even the first hour feels to me a little too much like, wouldn't it be nice if life was like this? It's not like this, but wouldn't it be nice if life was like this? To which I reply, but it's not like this. And I think all the performances are good in the first half, and I enjoy it. I always enjoy this movie. There's not a single second in this movie that I don't enjoy, but it never really goes deeper. So I'm curious, though, where this break was for you.
Because the thing is, and the break really, because the first half, you're right, is it's kind of a fantasy land version of all this. Everyone's really nice. Everyone's a lot better. Also, one brief takeaway, a little surprise, like, it kind of feels like Billy Crudup should have become a bigger movie star after this movie. Like, he's really charming, and he's all, like, of all the actors, I think Patrick Fuji is fine, and Kate Hudson is very charming, and Philip Seymour Hoffman is obviously Philip Seymour Hoffman, and Frances McDormand is actually really great in this movie. I kept wanting her to come back a little bit more often, but to me, Billy Crudup is magnetic and kind of a dick, but also like he really like popped for me in this. I know that's the term we use for an actor that we really like. He really popped for me in this movie. I really was like, wow, why has Billy Crudup not been like the biggest movie star over the last 15 years? Because I think he's absolutely terrific in this. But the kind of dream aspect, I think there is, it's not like the movie's filmed in a dreamlike way, but I think this kind of like the thing that you talked about, it's not, the world's not like this, but wouldn't it be nice if it were like this? I think there's a lot that little spell works for the first half. And then Jimmy Fallon shows up.
Go ahead.
So Jimmy Fallon shows up playing Dennis Hope, who is basically in a movie that did not cast a guy because they thought he was charming. In this role, like, this is like, I mean, this guy is the coming storm. Like, this guy's arrival on the scene, and he comes in as the guy from the studio who tries to show that Noah Taylor's manager character isn't going to take care of everything for you. He's the suit. He's the guy that's not about the music, man. And he's the guy, he's supposed to be the bad guy. There should be some threat to him or some sort of substance at all. But Jimmy Fallon shows up, and within 2 minutes, we get him doing a dipshit little Mick Jagger dance, because of course Jimmy Fallon's got to do that. And we get a joke of, do you think Mick Jagger's going to be out there dancing on the stage in 25 years? Which is, as you and I have talked many times, one of the biggest pet peeves in period pieces. It's the mockery of the great weddings, of the wedding singer. Hey, take that band off. Take that shirt off before you curse the band and make it break up. Get it? It's not 1984 now.
My version of that, by the way, is in Titanic when Billy Zane is talking about, was it Picasso? I'm trying to think, what painter?
Yeah.
He's like, who's heard of this painter? Like, oh, he's an idiot. Yes.
Yes, exactly. And it's not just Jimmy Fallon's fault as much as I would like it to be. As much as it is, like, A, it sets the movie into its, and now things are going to start going wrong path. And I feel like the movie loses, it not only, it loses that spell, and once it loses that spell is really the reason you're watching the movie in the first place. So we get a lot of, like, the conflict that comes with that, it starts feeling a lot more contrived, and you get moments like, listen, I know a lot of people like that plane scene where the plane's about to crash. I am not one of them. I feel like that scene is completely contrived, very kind of dumb, and it's basically a, hey, I have all these characters, and I need a way for them to all have a big emotional moments at the and have the movie end. Let's have maybe a plane crash. And I feel like all that starts when Jimmy Fallon's character comes on. I wonder if that character could have been better played, if it had been a darker actor. Like, that's a potentially fun role, the evil suit guy that comes in and messes up the band. But he comes on and just, like, dances and jigs for a little bit and looks like an idiot.
Have you seen Roadies?
I've not seen Roadies.
Because I only saw, like, the first few episodes when I was reviewing it. And that's the problem with Roadies, too. Now, my understanding is it's gotten better, but I kind of have a tough time believing that. But Roadies has the same thing where they have most of the characters love the road and love the music, and it's all about the rock and roll and all of that. And then they introduce the heavy-handed jerk guy on that show. And watching Almost Famous, I went, oh, God, this really is the same shtick that he did in this movie and that he did later in the TV show. We could have a whole podcast about why Jimmy Fallon drives us crazy, but it's funny, that wasn't the breaking point for me, because to me it just feels part and parcel with what I consider sort of imaginary land that Cameron Crowe's movies. Like, listen, I like Jerry Maguire a lot, and I like Say Anything a lot. I would argue that after those two movies, his movies became much more of a pretend real world as opposed to a real world that he had a really great sort of take on. And so, yes, when Jimmy Fallon shows up, when there is this kind of, to me, ridiculous conflict about, oh, he traded Kate Hudson's character for, you know, by the way, Kate Hudson is perfectly fine and really enjoyable in this movie. I will say, 16 years down the road, I am glad she didn't win the Oscar for this. Because she was favored at the time, and instead, the actress from from Pollock ended up pulling up the
Marcia Gay Harden.
Yeah, Marcia Gay Harden won. I think she's much better. And frankly, Frances McDormand might actually be better than Kate Hudson in this movie. So that's like that whole thing is a problem. I think just in general, you know, this is a movie that thinks it's cute to have Jan Wenner, who is the head of Rolling Stone, show up and do a cameo. If you've watched this movie recently and wondered when William is running around in New York trying to find Penny Lane, and he looks into a car, and there's a guy who looks at him quizzically, and the camera stays on him for way too long. Surprise, that's Jan Wenner, so that's like the fun cameo. This is a movie that is, you know, we talked about this with Don't Think Twice, the Mike Birbiglia movie that I liked over the summer that we both liked. I am not opposed to a movie that is nice and sweet and adorable, and the characters are basically decent. But my argument against a movie like Almost Famous, which again, I like and find very entertaining, is that for that movie to really feel real and to really have stakes and weight so that you understand why Cameron Crowe still feels so passionately about that time in his life that's now, you know, almost like 25 years, 30 years removed from where he was at that time, it's got to feel rawer and realer. And that movie just, and Almost Famous just doesn't do that to me. One moment that you didn't mention that I thought you might, that's often talked about with this movie, is when the band has the big, angry, almost breakup scene, and they all get on the bus and they listen to Elton John. That moment is really nicely done. And it's very genuine to the way people are, in that, you know what, we've had this big fight, nobody wants to talk to each other, but you know what, we all love this song, and this song connects us and reminds us of why this stuff matters. That's a really great moment. But I think that this was kind of the beginning of Cameron Crowe's kind of slipping, where his movies were more and more popular with those type of like grace note moments where it's like, oh, that'll be nice. That'll be nice. And I feel like the emotional connective tissue is not there to the extent that I would like. Again, I feel like I need to say this for the record. I still like this movie, but I found myself thinking all those years ago, I was right about how I felt about this movie. And one last thing I just have to say, I still think it's an absolute crime. This movie won Best Original Screenplay over Kenneth Lonergan's You Can Count on Me. That movie is fantastic. That script is fantastic. I remember being angry in 2001 when Cameron Crowe won. I'm still really angry about it. Like between that and Crash winning Best Picture, those are two that kind of like stick in my
year.
I would say like in terms of wins, those are two wins that stick in my craw. But yeah.
I'm curious. Do you think the Cameron Crowe meltdown that has happened? I don't mean personal meltdown, but I mean the movies that came after this: Vanilla Sky, Elizabethtown, We Bought a Zoo, and Aloha. Like just like increasing nightmares down all the way through. Do you think the seeds were always there for that, or do you think he lost something that was important from those first movies?
And I would also kind of add Roadies to that because Roadies also feels very much like, I know how to do my cutesy relationship dialogue stuff. And if I sound dismissive the way I say that, it's because I feel like it's like solidified into a shtick now, where I think with both Jerry Maguire and Say Anything, it really felt fresh. In some ways, he almost has the problem that Tarantino has faced, where because both of them have such distinctive dialogue styles that they're kind of trapped in terms of, well, how do I not repeat myself? But this is the thing I do. And I think Cameron Crowe has not been able to figure that out. Though I have to say, there's so many fun surprise like cameos of people who would be bigger later in this movie that are kind of fun. It's like, you know, people kind of pop up sort of here and there. I had forgotten that the guy from Sun Kil Moon was in the band. It's sort of fun to see him with long hair. There's a couple of like different like smaller actor, stand-up comedians are in this thing.
Eric Stone Street shows up very briefly.
Oh, that's right. Yes, I forgot that.
So again, I liked the first hour of the movie more than I did last time. But yeah, I think you're right. There's really no better way to put it. It's imagination land.
Yeah, and I think that is a tough thing to pull off. To sustain it, I think, is really, really kind of difficult. And clearly a lot of people love it, so I think that it does work for people, but I just can't get there, unfortunately.
All right, so that is Almost Famous, first of our two reboot sections. The second movie and our final reboot section movie of the week is another movie that we may or may not destroy from your childhood that you loved. It is Garden State.
We're not going to make out or anything.
What?
I'm sorry. I just like totally ruined that moment, didn't I? No. It's just that like we're not gonna make out, okay?
No, I hadn't planned on trying.
Oh my, I am so lame. That was like really, I'm sorry. I forget I just said that. That's dumb. And you know what I do when I feel completely unoriginal? Blah, 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 blah. I make a noise or I do something that no one has ever done before and then I can feel unique again, even if it's only for like a second.
So no one's ever done that?
No, not in this spot, no. You just witnessed a completely original moment in human history.
Garden State came out in 2004. It was a huge, huge Sundance smash that January. It was the feature directorial debut of Zach Braff, who at that time was only known really for being the star of Scrubs. He wrote and directed this movie that also stars Natalie Portman, Peter Sarsgaard, and Ian Holm. He plays a struggling actor living in Los Angeles who finds out that his mother has died. So he flies very reluctantly back home to New Jersey to reunite with his therapist father, Ian Holm, with whom he has a very distant relationship. And the movie is about this guy Braff plays named Andrew. Kind of, you know, he's already kind of at a weird crossroads in his life. He's unhappy. He's heavily medicated. And so he really is sort of coming home and having this sort of coming of age story where he falls in love with a quirky manic pixie dream girl played by Natalie Portman. Before we get into this, I have to say that of reboot movies that have been suggested to us, I don't think a movie filled me with more trepidation before seeing it again than Garden State. And this is the reason why. I was a big fan of this movie at the time. And the reason why I liked it specifically at the time is I felt that what Zach Braff did was incredibly earnest, incredibly there's nothing hip or cool about this movie. But I found it to be, at the time, really emotional. And I found it to be very affecting. And his relationship with Natalie Portman to be very, very affecting. And I thought it did kind of hit on that kind of 20-something angst, not knowing where your life is going kind of thing. I thought the use of the soundtrack, which, by the way, were songs that he wrote the movie to and basically put in the script, this song will play here, this song will play there, because he was Zach Braff, he was able to get the rights to those songs. And I really liked it at the time. This movie has been summarily trashed for the last 12 years, and I thought to myself, did I miss the boat? Did I miss the boat? So when this came up, I was both excited and very nervous. I forget, though, Will, did you hate this movie at the time? What was your thought about it?
Yeah, I didn't. I'll say that I did not like it when it first came out. And watching the hate in other people grow, that was stronger than my hate. But I'll confess, it was kind of fun to ride that wave a little bit.
Right.
I didn't like it. And one of the main reasons I didn't like it was, I mean, just frankly, Zach Braff himself. And I found, even when I saw it initially, there's a self-containedness. There's an ego. It is the classic, I found at the time, the classic, I'm so great, why does not everybody love me? sort of thing that I think eases through every pore. And I wonder if it would have been different if like someone else would have played that role, because I don't find him a particularly fun actor, and I don't find him particularly likable in a lot of ways. So that was an issue seeing it then. So we had those different experiences then. I'm going to keep everyone in waiting for where you are, because I actually, I think it's better. It's bigger, more important, because I want to see where you stand. But also I want to say there are certain parts of it that I liked more than I remembered. A lot of that little whimsy touch goes a long way, but there's still some nice little weird moments where, like, the fact that the moment where they're seeing once times three times a lady, it's actually not at her funeral. It's just like this weird surreal Jersey touch that kind of worked. The little joke about the shirt, the shirt being made out of material of the wallpaper, it's a funny visual joke. And there's like occasional little like directorial touches that are kind of clever and kind of funny. So there's certain things, and I feel like the fact that Peter Sarsgaard plays his best friend character salvages, like, in a horrible nightmare universe, that character is played by like Horatio Sands.
We've gotten Jimmy Fallon and Horatio Sands on this podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
Both of our, yes.
But like, think about like the stoner guy with all these wacky get rich schemes who's also a gravedigger. Like, that's a stupid ass character. But Peter Sarsgaard is such a good actor, and we have sung his praises many times in this podcast. But he's such a good actor that like he makes a character in that out of whole cloth that I found myself like, oh man, that character's stupid and so poorly written. But I love Peter Sarsgaard. So I found myself liking that much of it. I'll say, watching it this time, I'm like, wait, how is this guy an actor? A major takeaway from this, the idea that Zach Braff's character is an actor coming back, that like that is totally like, oh, this script was written by an actor. So therefore, because there is nothing, he is not only non-charismatic, but the idea that like this guy, who of course has been overly medicated for 12 years and seems to have no emotion and can feel nothing, that seems like maybe acting is not the field for that person.
have you maybe considered another profession?
Yeah, it struck me as a little strange that like that is totally Zach Braff being like, I don't know, I'm an actor. I'll make my main character.
I'll just be me. Yeah.
I'll just be me. Even though the whole point of this guy is that no, he can't feel anything and he has no access to his emotions. But he's a successful actor, I guess, is kind of a weird thing. I still feel like so much of the Natalie Portman stuff is this is one of the famous origins of the Manic Pixie Dream Girl stuff. I'll let you get into that a little bit because I expect you have more to say. There's a lot of stuff that has not aged well. That hotel Peeping Tom scene with Method Man.
Yeah.
Whoa. Yikes.
Yeah.
Yikes. That has not aged well at all. Leaving that aside, I still don't think the movie's very good, but I found myself going into it in a different way than you, going into it with a, I really didn't like this movie. Let's see if I can find some pearls in it. There were a few pearls. Now, Grierson, take it away.
You didn't even mention Dennis O'Hare playing Albert.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Playing guy that randomly lives at the bottom of an abyss for, you know, thematic convenience.
Yes. This movie is extremely well cast. That's the first thing I want to say, which should, by the way, be a preview, perhaps, of what I'm going to say about this movie, if I'm starting with the casting. It's I was incredibly impressed. Like, you know, Anne Dowd is in this. It's really like they found the right people to do lots of things. I mean, obviously, he had the clout and he had the right people to cast this. Gene Smart, I think, is really good in a really dumb role. Even like Ron Liebman as the neurologist that he goes to visit. Like, it's for one scene performances, there's a lot of, I think, really well cast stuff. Also, I think worth mentioning, since we talked about this last week with War Dogs, this movie is shot by Lauren Schur, who has gone on to be Todd Phillips' DP. It looks really good. This actually, I think when I look back at this time, in terms of why I think the movie spoke to me back in 2004, it is a Sundance movie that actually is pretty well composed. It's got a lot of the Sundance problems. It's overly earnest. It's got that type of soundtrack that tells you how to feel at all times. But it actually looks a hell of a lot better. And I think Lauren sure has a lot to do with that. It was pretty deflating watching it this time, I have to say. I mean, this is the thing I actually want to say about Zach Braff. I had seen his second film, Wish I Was Here, also at Sundance. I actually saw that movie at Sundance. Next to people who absolutely despised it from minute one to the end. And I will defend that movie mostly because I think that the stuff that doesn't work in it really doesn't work. But the core story about him and his father is really, really well done. Watching Garden State, though, I thought, oh, this is the same thing that he did in Garden State. The father's not dying in this movie, but it's, again, about a complicated father-son relationship, kind of coming of age, kind of man-child growing up kind of thing. I think the two things that really hurt this movie are, number one, as you said, I think that this type of movie has not aged well. You know, you go to Sundance every year, you are going to see five or six movies about white people in their 20s who, gosh darn it, just can't pull their lives together. Maybe they have a dying parent. Maybe they have a dead parent. Maybe they have some sort of relationship issue. And it gets kind of wearying. And so that plot doesn't help. And I think the other thing is that, frankly, the relationship between him and Natalie Portman is not that interesting. When this movie came out, and I think this is important to kind of acknowledge and remember, this was at the time when she was doing the Star Wars prequels. And I think that there was this kind of sense of, oh no, Natalie Portman can't act anymore. And so I think that, I'll only speak for myself, I think I overrated her in this because it actually felt more genuine, more human, more vulnerable than the stone-faced, you know, Princess Amidala, whatever her name was, in the Star Wars prequels. I don't want to beat up on this movie too much, but it just...
Go ahead.
I don't think it's bad. I just don't think it works. I watched the movie and I think there's just enough stuff here that's just kind of clunky that I've seen in thousands of other movies of this type. There are nice moments. And that's, I have to say, pairing this with Almost Famous is kind of great because they both have these moments, I think, that are surprising or touching or whatever, that, at least for me watching both movies, I went, okay, can you pull like the emotional like manipulation any harder? But damn it, it kind of works. Like that scene when they're all yelling to on top of that like dumpster or whatever it is, and they have the Simon and Garfunkel song, that is a dumb moment. I have to admit, it works for me because of just how over the top it is, how shameless it is. There is a purity of that that I kind of respect in a way. But overall, it just feels like a guy, speaking of the character, who's just sort of aimlessly drifting and hasn't earned the right to really be in the kind of the spiritual abyss that he finds himself in. I think the development of what happens and why his mom ended up the way that she is and why there's a tension with his father, it's okay. But I just watched it this time feeling like, oh, I've seen this movie before and there's nothing that new. And I would be really curious to go back and ask myself, because this must have felt more novel at the time, because now it definitely doesn't feel novel at all.
You know, also, again, I'm going to pile on a little bit now. Just the way the movie is so filtered, not just through the eyes of the character, but through Zach Braff's eyes as the guy who wrote the character, who is really just him. Like the idea that, like, first off, you know, we have to have a moment where Natalie Portman is epileptic, which is a bomb that never goes off, by the way. Like, that's Chekhov's gun that never fires. It basically just gives her a way to look vulnerable, a way for him to someone to protect. And then, but of course, ultimately, she becomes his mother, and the whole thing, and his big lessons that he learns at the end are nothing involving her or his relationship with her, or, you know, this is love, are these things that all these people do for me. Like, that is ultimately when he has this moment, like, that's love. That's love. It's people doing things for him. Like, that is ultimately what his ultimate definitions of these things are. So, yeah, like, I found that the reason that those people had the claws out for Wish I Was Here, which, other than the fact that that's really what he called it.
and it was a Kickstarter thing. And, there were several. Not to bring up a thing that drives you crazy, but, yes, that was also part of it, too. Yes.
I'll put it this way. Like, this movie has not aged well, and I think people really go after this movie a lot of ways. It's hard to say that, in at least on several occasions, he's not kind of asking for it.
Yeah, I think for me what is hard is that the movie is not tough enough on that character. Because I do have to say that there is a part of me that respects the shameless earnestness of his movies. There is a thing about that I do kind of like, but even on that level, I did not notice just how many times other the supporting characters of the movie are treated like they're idiots. I mean, there's so many times where Jim Parsons' character, or just guys that he meets, like, this movie is very ungenerous to the people that he meets that he grew up with. And that is actually, to me, sort of actually the deal breaker for me in this movie, that he doesn't meet people from his childhood who are now adults and think they're struggling like I am. They have their issues like I am. There's sort of this idea that he's different than them and that he's maybe better than them. And that actually is, to me, the thing I find most irritating this time when I watch it, is that the movie is actually not as earnest as it is. It's not very generous. And to me, if you're going to be that way, you have to be kind to the other characters, because they haven't done anything to deserve, I think, the scorn that they kind of get in this movie. So Garden States, alas, has not held up.
Ah, right. Well, listen, I love it when our reboot, people that give us reboot movies that make you eat crow. That is one of my favorite things.
I don't want to say it's eating crow. It's just... what's the campaign presidential type of thing to say? I am, you know, I'm evolving on the issue. I'm evolving on the issue of if Garden State is good or not.
It is an ongoing process.
Yes.
Exactly. Listen, human beings change their minds. We're all evolving people. It's like there's something about a shark, and it's not. I don't know what it is. All right, so that is Garden State. So thank you for our movies. I thought those were excellent reboot decisions. Those were both really fun ones.
Yeah, fun and a fun pairing between those, both kind of coming of age, soundtrack rich films. Yeah.
Yes. So we remind everyone to make sure to go to iTunes or SoundCloud, by the way. You can also review us on SoundCloud. Those will count as well. And give us a nice review in the name of a movie. We will talk about it on the podcast. That's all for this show. But next week, once again, two straight weeks. I hope people liked the show, Kirsten, because it's going to be another week next week where we don't have a specific movie review. It's Labor Day. This is the time of year where things chill out. This is the transition between the summer movie season and the big serious awards movie season. So there's not a lot of big movies coming out. So we're actually taking advantage of that to do this podcast. And next week, Grierson, you are about to go to the Toronto Film Festival. How many years have you gone to the Toronto Film Festival?
Oh, shoot. This might be my sixth year.
So very, very regular for you. And we'll talk about the specifics of that film festival next week. But you're going. So we're going to have next week is a Toronto Film Festival preview. I'm going to talk about the movies that you're going to see, some of the movies you're excited about, some of your past experiences in Toronto. It'll be a really fun podcast where I basically just interview you. So I don't have to give any of myself, and you have to give everything that you have.
But maybe I'll eat some more crow. I know you love that. So maybe there'll be,
I love it when you eat
maybe
crow.
There'll be more, maybe there'll be more crow eating.
I want to go. Yeah.
Just this because like I'm growing, man.
This one was a great one though, because I've given you shit about Garden State before.
I think it's more the shins, haven't you? It's more the shins that you've given me crap about.
Yeah, I guess.
Shoes Too Narrow is still a great album. I stand behind that. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so next week we're going to talk about the Toronto Film Festival.
Such anger towards the shins all of a sudden. Go ahead. Anyway.
Because that's only a certain section, we're actually going to have three reboots next week, though one of them will be very short in the Gymkhana sense for reasons that will become apparent very soon. But the first movie we're going to talk about in our reboot, so you can all watch it together next week. And by the way, I think I'm going to start putting on Twitter the day after the podcast comes out, a reminder for everyone, hey, here's the movies if you want to watch this week, so you can all be a part of the reboot section. So the first movie of our reboot section is Escape from New York, written and directed by John Carpenter from 1981, starring Kurt Russell and Donald Pleasence, Ernest Borgnine. People like that movie, man.
They do. They love that movie.
Have you seen it? I don't think I've seen it.
I have seen bits and pieces of it, so I might as well just say no. Because it's been so long since I've even seen the bits and pieces, so yes.
Yes, I have not seen it, so I'm very excited to, as I'm a little embarrassed to say, so I'm glad to be able to say we will be seeing Escape from New York next week. The second movie is a movie I have seen, but it's been since it came out that I saw it, which, good Lord, has been more than 20 years what has happened to us, Grierson, is 12 Monkeys, directed by Terry Gilliam, starring Bruce Willis, Madeline Stowe, and Brad Pitt, a futuristic time travel, the time travel craziness movie from Terry Gilliam, 1995. I'm very excited to see that one. It's also a TV series now, right?
I have not seen the TV series, but yes, it's a sci-fi series now. Yeah.
Okay. Well, it seems difficult. Movies kind of stories kind of self-contained, but regardless. And then our third movie, Gearson's already giggling.
No, I was giggling because this summer has taught us anything, my friend. It's that it doesn't matter. You can just keep creating new content, even if they the Jason Bourne example. But I am giggling because what are you making me do? What are you making me say? Yes.
I am not doing this. The readers are doing this. More specifically, my wife is making us do this because our third movie is Teen Witch from 1989, directed by Dorian Walker, starring Robin Lively, Dan Gauthier, Joe. I don't know who any of these people are.
To answer your question, I haven't seen this movie. Yes. Your lovely wife has made impeccable decisions throughout her life, even marrying you. This one, I don't know. Does she like this movie? That's my question. Is she torturing us? What's the deal?
No, this is far from it. This is she loves this movie. We were actually at dinner with friends last week, and she told them that I was finally going to be doing her movie for the reboot section. And the people that at the table with, they were like, oh my God, Teen Witch. They were so excited. So I have no idea why. I'm looking at the Wikipedia page. Literally, the first line is, originally pitched as a female version of Teen Wolf, the film features numerous impromptu rap musical numbers.
Oh God.
So
this is the Gymkhana of...
Yeah, that's why we're doing the third one, because we only have a but I love my wife, and she has excellent taste in many, many things. We will find out if this is one of them. So the third movie is Teen Witch. And for what it's worth, I suspect there are going to be a lot of people listening to this being like, oh my God, Teen Witch. And we are, I think we, the point of this is that we are the assholes, Grierson.
I was going to say, this may be a Hook situation where we find out how beloved the movie is that we are not even, cognizant of. So I always go in with an open mind. I am looking forward to watching Teen Witch.
Exactly. All right, so Grierson, good show this week. We're going to catch you right before you go to Toronto next week, but it should be a good time. So and I'm glad that you had to suck it on that made me happy.
I want our readers and listeners to know I'm the one that selected it. I leaned into the bullets on this one, so yes.
Do you lean into bullets? I think you just kind of have to take them.
If you lean into them, it's even more of a selfless act, I think. It's even braver, I think.
Well, fingers crossed, this podcast will be the last time we ever discuss Warcraft. Otherwise, have a great week, everyone. Grierson, good show. We'll be back next week to talk about the Toronto Film Festival, Escape from New York, 12 Monkeys, and Teen Witch.
Teen Witch, bye. Just last night I woke from some uncontinuable dream. Had a nail to my forehead again. Keep this-